Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Tuesday, May 26, 2026, and this is our Commodities and Energy Edition.
Today, we are examining the fraying edges of global supply stability, where the era of predictable, low-cost logistics is being replaced by a period of structural volatility. We are seeing a fundamental shift from a focus on just-in-time efficiency to a new high-cost reality defined by geopolitical friction and resource competition.
So we're moving from a world of surplus to a world of strategic scarcity.
There's a signal here, MAYA. We begin our analysis by looking closely at energy choke points in the global oil shock.
6 million barrels of oil managed to pass through the Strait of Hormuz recently, which sounds like a victory, but WTI crude is still hovering near $98 and the geopolitical floor is looking incredibly shaky. Today, we're looking at energy choke points and the looming shadow of a global oil shock.
It is a period of extreme tension, Maya. While that specific shipment provided a momentary breather, the structural integrity of the global energy supply chain is under unprecedented strain due to the ongoing conflict in Iran and the recent two-month closure of the strait.
It is wild to think we are essentially one rogue drone away from a complete breakdown of global logistics. I mean, we're talking about the fundamental plumbing of the modern world just stopping.
It's more than just a pause, though. We are seeing the emergence of what some are calling the Persian Gulf Strait Authority in Iran, which introduces a new, unregulated layer of maritime governance. This makes navigating the strait much more complex for ship operators, as the rules of the road are effectively being rewritten in real time.
So it's not just about whether the water is clear, it's about whether the new landlord allows you to pass.
Consider this, the implications for the downstream supply chain are already manifesting. According to Argus Media, this disruption has created a multi-layered cost escalation for DAP, diammonium phosphate, in Southeast Asia. The tightening of the global sulfur supply, combined with roughly 70,000 to 75,000 tons of stranded DAP, is driving up freight rates because of the spike in bunker fuel costs.
So the oil crisis is feeding the fertilizer crisis, which then feeds the food crisis. It's a very efficient way to destabilize a planet.
It's a cascading failure. And it's not just crude oil. We're seeing a massive strain on the LPG market. Gary Clark has noted that while propane is being hit, the butane market is facing even more severe pressure because the Arab Gulf supply mix, which is roughly a 50-50 split of butane and propane, is being locked up. This is a specific vulnerability for nations like India and Indonesia that rely on that butane for residential energy security.
Which means people aren't just paying more for gas in their cars, they're paying more to literally keep the lights and heat on.
Worth noting, the volatility is spreading to other petrochemical feedstocks. In China, producers are already accelerating a pivot away from Middle Eastern naphtha and LPG, moving instead toward U.S. ethane to bypass the disrupted supply chains. It's a massive, expensive shift in global trade flows.
Let's talk about the big number everyone is whispered about in the trading pits. We've seen $100, we've seen $98. But there's this persistent rumor of $200. Is that a mathematical possibility or just high-octane fearmongering?
It is a mathematical possibility if the disruption reaches a certain threshold. Morgan Downey on Macro Voices argued that if the current Strait of Hormuz disruption continues for just another month, oil prices could surge into the $150 to $200 range. The reason is that the market is moving past the final slugs of available U.S. strategic petroleum, reserve releases, and excess floating inventories. We are running out of buffers.
Wait, you're telling me the safety net is essentially empty?
The U.S. SPR is being depleted, and the depletion of inventories in both the U.S. and Asia is creating a hand-to-mouth market. Amrita Sen on Bloomberg Surveillance warned that we are approaching a critical period by the end of June 2026. If we don't see a significant restocking, the lack of available crude could push prices toward the $160 to $170 range.
And I assume there's no quick fix button here. You can't just turn a tap and fix a shortage.
You can't. The oil market functions as a physical flywheel rather than an electronic transaction. Even if a peace agreement were signed today, the logistical lag of tankers and the engineering complexity of restarting shut-in wells means any recovery could be delayed until late July 2026. There is a massive aftermath story here involving the time it takes to restore tanker traffic and harden infrastructure.
So even good news comes with a massive delay. It's like trying to restart a frozen engine in the middle of winter.
That's a good way to put it. And there is a structural aversion to shutting in production in the first place. As noted in Macro Voices, the industry avoids shutting in wells because it causes significant technical complications. This acts as a persistent supply-side pressure. The market can't easily absorb a shock because the cost of stopping and starting production is too high.
So the system is essentially built to keep running even when it's breaking.
And that's where the extreme scenario comes in. As Aldo Spanger discussed with Paul Chapman, If we see kinetic escalation, actual direct military action, it could drive oil toward $200 and gas toward $115 per unit through Q3. We aren't just talking about a volume deficit of 4 to 4.5 million barrels per day. We are talking about a systemic risk to the ability to re-establish trust in transit mechanisms.
Let's zoom out for a second. If the Middle East is becoming too volatile to rely on, does this mean the oil age is actually hitting a wall?
It's shifting the focus. There is a fundamental geopolitical shift happening from petrostates to electrostates. As the energy evolution analysis points out, national security is being redefined by control over electrification infrastructure rather than just oil reserves. Lucas Perelin has even suggested that the price shocks from the war in Iran might be the primary non-environmental catalyst for the energy transition, forcing consumer nations to seek alternatives simply because they cannot afford the volatility.
So energy security is becoming the new environmentalism. It's not about saving the planet, it's about not being held hostage by a pipeline.
The pattern is clear. While we wait for that long-term transition, we have immediate localized crises. For instance, Paul Sankey has pointed out a physical shortage of Group 3 base oils. This is creating a downstream supply chain crisis in the U.S., impacting the ability of major retailers like Walmart and Costco to stock engine oils because they rely so heavily on imports from the Strait.
It's getting to the point where the disruption isn't just on a Bloomberg terminal, it's on the shelves of your local big box store.
It is.
And we should also consider the hidden capacity. Some might argue that we have more breathing room than we think, but the reality is that global energy infrastructure faces a critical operational threshold. As Unhedge noted, oil tanks and pipelines cannot safely drop below roughly 25% capacity without causing clogging and significant mechanical issues. We are reaching the point where we aren't just managing supply, we are managing the physical integrity of the entire system.
And the corporations aren't even holding true stockpiles. They're just holding the bare minimum to keep the pipes from seizing up.
The reserves are often just essential working capital. We are seeing a long-term structural shift, though. Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Iraq are already investing between $50 and $75 billion in overland pipelines to bypass the Strait of Hormuz entirely. They want to ensure that within 5 years, the Strait ceases to function as a global market choke point.
So the players are already building the bypass, even as the main road is on fire.
They have to.
The goal is to decouple global energy security from this single, vulnerable maritime corridor. But until those pipelines are operational and the aftermath of the current conflict is resolved, we are stuck in this high-volatility, high-risk cycle.
Implication: energy traders and downstream manufacturers must prepare for a period of sustained input cost volatility that persists even if a localized ceasefire is achieved. One thing to watch: keep a very close eye on the US EIA oil stock data in late June. Any signal of a failure to restock inventories will likely be the trigger for the next major price surge. Macro uncertainty and the inflation ghost. I was reading through the latest macro briefings this morning, and I've come to the conclusion that we are living in a very expensive piece of performance art. We have a monetary fiscal feedback loop where the government is spending more, the Fed is watching, and yet somehow the more we print, the more we seem to be stuck in a loop of just printing more.
It's not exactly performance art, Maya, it's more of a structural imbalance. According to the macro trading floor, we're seeing a primary fiscal deficit reaching 80 basis points of GDP. And when you combine that with massive private credit creation specifically for AI capital expenditures, you get money creation at the 80th percentile of historical levels.
So to translate, the government is running a massive deficit, big tech is borrowing a fortune to build more data centers, and we're all just riding this wave of liquidity until it hits a rock.
That's the long risk trade. But the rock might be the inflation ghost. We're seeing a shift where inflation isn't just a temporary spike, it's becoming structural because of the AI transition. Before we see any productivity gains from AI, we have to endure the massive inflationary phase of building the hardware, which is driving up costs for everything from semiconductors to energy.
Right, because you can't have a digital revolution without a very physical, very expensive pile of silicon and copper. It's a bit like trying to build a skyscraper by buying every piece of steel on the market at once. Of course, the price goes up.
The data tells a story, it's not just the tech itself. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts noted that the bond market is currently navigating a three-phase sell-off. First, an inflation shock in importing countries, then a period of real yield expansion driven by growth, and now technical selling from convexity hedgers reducing their duration.
Which sounds like a very sophisticated way of saying the bond market is panicking about how much the US government is about to spend.
It's more specific than that. On Bloomberg Surveillance, they described the current environment as a deceptive illusion of stability. Even though nominal interest rates are high, the rising inflation rate is actually shrinking the real funds rate. So functionally, monetary policy is actually easing even while the headline numbers look restrictive.
The Fed is effectively stepping on the gas while the dashboard tells us we're braking. That is remarkably efficient at creating confusion.
It's also creating a massive supply-side headache for commodities. On Bloomberg Surveillance, they pointed out that the high inflation rate is actually shrinking the real funds rate, which hides the fact that we are facing real supply-driven shocks. We're seeing a Mincio VLD effect in the supply chain, where bottlenecks in nitrogen, plastics, and energy are creating a persistent inflationary floor. Unlike an energy spike that you can just turn off, these are non-interruptible commodities.
I love that term, non-interruptible. It's much more dignified than we can't find enough fertilizer to grow crops.
But it matters because it forces a pivot in how we value assets. We are seeing a massive surge in the CPI for computer software and accessories, moving from negative 5% to 14% year over year. This isn't just software, it's the hardware layer. When you see 25% to 26% year-over-year increases in semiconductor costs, as David Dole highlighted, that cost eventually finds its way into the energy and materials sectors.
And it's not just the U.S. either. I noticed some talk about Canada having a bit of a buffer because of their labor market, while the U.S. is just, well, running hot.
That's true. There is a diverging inflation trajectory because the U.S. lacks the labor slack that Canada has. It's making a 4% headline inflation rate in the U.S. look like a very plausible, if temporary, outcome for later this year. And this all ties back to the long end of the yield curve. Katrin Bone from DWS noted that the recent global bear steepening is a direct expression of fiscal deficit concerns, specifically the rising cost of servicing debt and increasing defense budgets.
Which brings us to the inevitable math problem. If the cost of servicing this debt keeps climbing, someone has to pay for it.
And the math is getting grim. According to FICC Focus, fiscal mathematics dictates that by May 2027, the U.S. government will likely be forced to increase coupon issuance sizes because relying on cheaper short-term bill supply is becoming unsustainable given the rising cost of debt service and defense spending.
So by 2027, we aren't just looking at a deficit, we're looking at a fundamental restructuring of how the U.S. finances itself. It's almost like the government is being forced into a high interest rate regime by its own debt.
So here's the picture. The danger is that this could trigger a trilemma for emerging markets. We could see nations like Indonesia or the Philippines struggling to simultaneously sustain their economies, defend their currencies, and stabilize their bond markets. If energy transit in the Hormuz Strait is disrupted, that entire long-risk trade, which relies on stable energy flows, could be invalidated instantly.
It's a very fragile house of cards, held together by AI promises and massive amounts of cheap credit that isn't actually that cheap.
It's a transition period. We are moving from a disinflationary growth model to a much more volatile, high-rate environment. There's even debate within the Fed about whether they need to hike or cut, as they try to figure out if rising energy prices will drive inflation or simply crush growth.
It's the classic pick-your-poison scenario. Either we have inflation that eats our savings or high rates that starve our infrastructure.
And the infrastructure part is critical. As noted by the Columbia Energy Exchange, the real bottleneck for modernizing the energy grid isn't the technology, it's the interest rates. Because renewables and grid upgrades are so capital-intensive up front, a shift from 2% to 4% interest rates can fundamentally stall the entire deployment.
The very tool the Fed uses to fight inflation might be the thing that breaks our ability to transition to a more stable energy future.
It's a feedback loop that is becoming increasingly difficult to escape.
Implication: commodity investors need to reweight toward real assets and gold to hedge against a persistent, 1970s-style inflationary floor. One thing to watch, any significant disruption in energy flows through the Hormuz Strait, because that would be the trigger that turns a manageable inflation problem into a global earnings crisis. The AI infrastructure arms race.
Maya, I've been digging through the recent CapEx reports, and we are witnessing something far more visceral than just a software update. We are in the middle of a massive physical hardware-driven arms race that is fundamentally rewiring the global energy and commodities landscape.
An arms race? That sounds a bit dramatic, even for you, Alex. Are we talking about a sudden surge in Silicon Valley's procurement budgets, or are you predicting actual digital warfare?
It's a capital expenditure race, but the implications are all hard assets. Look at the supply-demand imbalance in the AI sector. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts highlighted a staggering 12-to-1 ratio in Taiwan recently. That imbalance is the primary driver behind unprecedented spending levels across both the tech and energy sectors. We aren't just buying chips, we are building entire power ecosystems.
It's less about the magic of AI and more about the sheer amount of copper and concrete required to keep the lights on.
It's a telling detail. The bottleneck has shifted. It's no longer just about who can design the most efficient GPU. As Andrew Feldman of Cerebras pointed out, the primary constraint is now physical infrastructure, specifically the availability of powered data center buildings and grid capacity. We are seeing a shift where the ability to rapidly deploy generation capacity, what Christian Brutsch at Siemens Energy calls speed to power, has become a new dimension of national and corporate supremacy.
I love that speed to power. It sounds like a high-stakes racing league, but instead of engines, we're just arguing over who can plug in a server farm first. But if this is all about building more, 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 doesn't that imply a massive drain on the economy?
It's already happening, and it's structurally inflationary. The macro trading floor argued that this AI transition is currently in an inflationary phase because the massive capex and the labor required to build this infrastructure act as a primary driver of cost increases long before we see any disinflationary productivity gains. We're seeing the top of the economy, the hyperscalers, spending aggressively, while the bottom is squeezed by rising prices, creating what Lakshman Achuthan describes as a K-shaped recovery.
So the AI boom is actually a hidden tax on the rest of us.
It's more than just a tax, it's a supply chain disruption. On Bloomberg Surveillance, it was noted that the surge in demand for high-value chips is crowding out the lower-end chips used in everyday consumer goods. This could add roughly 0.3% to core PCE inflation over the next few quarters. We even saw the consumer price index for computer software and accessories swing from minus 5% to 14% year-over-year. This isn't just a tech trend, it's a structural shift in the supply chain that could necessitate higher interest rates.
The cloud is getting much heavier and much more expensive. But if the tech giants are the ones spending all this money, are they actually the ones winning the commodity game?
That's the fascinating part. There's an extreme asymmetric investment opportunity right now. On Bloomberg Surveillance, analysts pointed out that while hyperscalers have an effectively zero free cash flow yield due to this massive spending, the Munificent Seven, the big oil companies, are offering a 15.5% free cash flow yield. The real upside might not be in the companies buying the chips, but in the energy producers supplying the power.
So the miners and the drillers are the ones holding the real leverage, while the tech companies play a very expensive game of Tetris with data centers.
Two things stand out. And the stakes are geopolitical, too. Deutsche Bank's Ozan Tarman and Aditya Singhal noted that the Western strategy is focused on massive parameter scaling, which requires massive power. Meanwhile, a self-sustaining Chinese ecosystem, using Huawei clusters and models like GLM5, threatens to disrupt that advantage by driving down global costs. Even the U.S. strategy is precarious. Rebuilding the U.S. semiconductor ecosystem requires $30 to $40 billion per fab and decades of political stability. But as the durability gap suggests, our short-term administration-dependent policy might not match the 25-year requirement for a functioning ecosystem.
Implication: energy regulators in the U.S. and Europe will have to accelerate grid interconnection approvals or risk a massive bottleneck in domestic AI scaling. One thing to watch: the next quarterly earnings from the major electrical equipment manufacturers, specifically looking for whether their order backlogs are accelerating alongside data center construction. Commodity supercycles and metal scarcity. I tried to organize my spice cabinet this morning, and honestly, the chaos of my cumin levels felt strangely relevant to the global commodities market. We are seeing this massive, messy scramble for everything from aluminum to fertilizer.
It's more than just a scramble, Maya. We're entering a structural supercycle. On Bloomberg Surveillance, Jeffrey Curry argued that a decade-long cycle is emerging because capex starvation in energy sectors is driving a rotation into hard assets.
So it's not just a temporary hiccup.
No, because the bottlenecks are systemic. Bloomberg Surveillance also noted a mini-COVID framework where disruptions in non-interruptible commodities, like nitrogen for fertilizer, create a much more stubborn inflationary floor than energy shocks, which can theoretically be switched off.
And speaking of things that can't be switched off, the fertilizer situation looks grim.
It's a perfect storm. With China's phosphate export suspension not expected to lift until at least August 2226, Southeast Asian importers are pivoting to Russia and Saudi Arabia. Add in the Strait of Hormuz disruption stranding 75,000 tons of DAP, and you have skyrocketing freight and sulfur costs.
It's like trying to host a dinner party where the main ingredient is stuck in a shipping container in a war zone.
And it's spilling into metals. The aluminum deficit forecasts have exploded from a few hundred thousand tons to nearly 2 million tons this year, an amount roughly equal to all visible global inventories.
Is there any relief coming from the U.S.?
Minimal. Argus Media reports the only imminent boost is Century Aluminum's 50,000-ton restart in South Carolina by late June, but other major projects like the EGA Century Oklahoma smelter are stalled without power agreements. Meanwhile, U.S. importers are trapped in a competition trap with Europe due to Section 232 tariffs.
And China is just playing its own game with steel, right?
Something to flag here, Argus Media highlights a margin arbitrage where Chinese mills are prioritizing high-margin carbon slab exports over HRC, actually reducing domestic steel supply to chase better global prices.
Implication: agricultural investors in Southeast Asia need to recalculate their input budgets for the 2026 planting season. One thing to watch: keep an eye on China's hydropower levels in Yunnan, because if they can't hit their 45 million ton aluminum target, the global shortage will intensify. the battery revolution and grid complexity. Alex, I've been reading about this data quality shock in the battery sector. Is that just a fancy industry term, for we have no idea what's actually happening inside these containers?
It's a bit more specific than that, but the scale is massive. We're seeing a transition from vertically integrated suppliers to a fragmented multi-vendor ecosystem. And as a result, storage assets are generating 10 to 100 times more data per megawatt than solar or wind.
So instead of a single dashboard, we've gone from a simple spreadsheet to a digital tsunami that no one can actually read.
The implication runs deeper. It's creating a massive performance gap. On Redefining Energy, analysts pointed out an unusable energy metric, where an installed 400 megawatt hour battery might only have 360 megawatt hours of functional capacity because of imbalanced cells or offline components. It's not just about what you bought, it's about what's actually operational.
That sounds like a nightmare for anyone trying to model revenue. And I assume the hardware isn't the part that's breaking.
Surprisingly, no. According to Redefining Energy, hardware commoditization is shifting the criticality of failures toward the control layer. Data shows that 40% of safety incidents stem from control systems and another 40% from balance of plant components like HVAC, leaving the actual battery cells to account for only 20% of the problem.
So the brain and the air conditioning are the real liabilities.
We can trace that further. The complexity is being forced by geopolitics too. Redefining Energy notes that new financing restrictions from the EIB and EIF, which prohibit investing in projects using Chinese-owned inverters after this November, are driving a debundling trend. Operators are now forced to source DC blocks, inverters, and management systems from separate, often more expensive, regional vendors.
So you're paying more for a fragmented puzzle that's harder to keep from catching fire.
It's getting even more technical. There is a critical distinction emerging between read-only analytics for monitoring and the read-write control layers used for grid stability. The latter is a massive cybersecurity vulnerability because it has the access necessary to physically steer the asset.
This changes the entire risk profile for infrastructure funds looking at long-term battery yields. Keep an eye on the EIB's November deadline. If we see a sudden spike in project delays in Europe, it means the supply chain decoupling is hitting much harder than the market realizes. As we wrap up this edition, the common thread through today's discussions isn't just market volatility, it is the physicalization of the global economy. We are witnessing a fundamental pivot where the digital ambitions of the AI era are colliding head-on with the finite realities of the Earth. Whether we are looking at the 12-to-1 supply-demand imbalance in Taiwan's AI hardware or the widening deficit in daily oil barrels, the era of frictionless, software-led growth is being superseded by a much more expensive, much more difficult struggle for tangible inputs.
That's exactly right. The implication here is that the calculus for capital allocators, particularly those managing large-scale infrastructure and sovereign debt, has shifted from managing cost to managing availability. You can no longer simply model for interest rate fluctuations or 0.3% creep in core PCE. You have to model for the possibility that the physical components of the transition, from industrial metals to grid-stabilizing battery cells, simply aren't moving through the pipes. For decision makers in the energy sector, the priority is no longer just decarbonization or margin expansion, but the mitigation of a systemic multi-sector bottleneck that threatens the reliability of the entire energy compute nexus.
It's a landscape where the stability of the grid and the price of WTI are increasingly tethered to the same structural fragility.
Moving forward, all eyes will be on the upcoming U.S. inventory reports. If we see a sustained drawdown that mirrors the recent disruptions in the Strait of Hormuz, it will confirm that we aren't just facing a temporary price spike, but a structural breakdown in our ability to buffer against supply shocks. That single data point will tell us if the market is still capable of absorbing volatility, or if the era of strategic buffers is officially behind us.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week.